Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, January 15th. Chinese President Hu Jintao, in a hugely important summit, is coming to Washington this week to meet with President Obama, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who knows a thing or two about China, said in a Washington Post op-ed that the risk of a U.S.-China Cold War, are on the rise and must be avoided. Kissinger says the nature of globalization and the reach of modern technology oblige the United States and China to interact around the world. A Cold War between them would bring about an international choosing of sides, spreading disputes into internal politics of every region at a time, when issues such as nuclear proliferation, the environment, energy, and climate change require a comprehensive global solution. Conflict is not inherent in a nation's rise, Kissinger says. Sino-U.S. relations need not take such a turn. On most contemporary issues, the two countries cooperate adequately. What the two countries lack is an overarching concept for their interaction. Well, this is no easy task. Dr. Kissinger continues, America's exceptionalism finds it's natural to condition its conduct towards, other societies on their acceptance of American values. Most Chinese see their country's rise not as a challenge to America, but as heralding a return to the normal state of affairs when China was preeminent. In the Chinese view, it is the past 200 years of relative weakness, not China's current resurgence, that represent an abnormality. American diplomacy pursues specific outcomes with single-minded determination. Chinese negotiators are more likely to view the process as combining political, economic, and strategic elements and to seek outcomes via an extended process. American negotiators become restless and impatient with deadlocks. Chinese negotiators consider them the inevitable mechanism of negotiation. American negotiators represent a society that has never suffered national catastrophe, except the Civil War, which is not viewed as an international experience. Chinese negotiators cannot forget the century of humiliation when foreign armies exacted tribute from a prostrate China. Chinese leaders are extremely sensitive to the slightest implication of condescension and are apt to translate American insistence as lack of respect. Mr. Kissinger nails that last point. Writing in a state paper on Friday, Wu Jinbo out of Fudan University in Shanghai said, quote, "With irreconcilable interest, it is impossible to eliminate policy differences, which limits the good relations. Today, China is disappointed, dissatisfied, and confused by the series of hardline policies against China in the second year of the Obama administration. China is worried that this is a sign of a current or future major reversal in U.S. policy and strategy toward China." Close quote. Have a scratchy throat this morning. Defense Secretary Gates told Japanese students of his visit with Hu Jintao and defense officials a few days after his trip to Beijing. While military relations between the two are better, Gates said, there is one big disagreement between the two sides, freedom of navigation. The U.S. believes it has the right to sail its ships in waters that China claims are restricted. Gates says, since our nation's founding, freedom of the seas and commerce are basic tenets. And when it comes to China's military, Gates said he has no doubt the Communist Party is in control, but, quote, sometimes there are disconnects. Gates was referring to the shocking disclosure that evidently President Hu did not know of the J-20 stealth fighter test flight being conducted the very day Gates was in discussions with Hu. Just as an aside, I was going back through some old notes. And on April 21st, 2007, after my first trip to see my investment in Fujian province, I wrote, "So, when I see 11% GDP growth, such as that announced for the first quarter, by China. It's no longer a shock to me. It also shouldn't be a shock to hear that tax revenues are up 25% more for China's military. Take note, Secretary Gates. It seems some in the Pentagon haven't been paying attention until now. In China, after after meeting with his counterpart, Defense Minister Liang, Gates said, quote, we are in strong agreement that in order to reduce the chances of miscommunication, misunderstanding, or miscalculation, it is important that our military-to-military ties are solid, consistent, and not subject to shifting political winds. But military ties are brittle, as are other aspects of the U.S.-China relationship. China, said Gates, had the potential to put some of our capabilities at risk. We have to pay attention to them. We have to respond appropriately with our own programs. One big issue on the defense front is the United States' ongoing arms sales to Taiwan. Liang said such sales, quote, have jeopardized China's core interest. Liang and China need to chill out. And the United States must stand firm when it comes to our ally. All in all, Gates' talks in Beijing went miserably, even as he did his best to put them in a favorable light. But it's not just Washington that is concerned about China's intentions. Some in Europe are concerned as well. From an editorial in the London Times, quote, the pictures of a Chinese stealth fighter jet apparently making its first test flight yesterday are one more indication of a concerted military buildup that makes nonsense of Beijing's official defense expenditure figures. Along with this new anti-ship ballistic missile, whose speedy creation appears to have taken the Pentagon by surprise, the pictures demonstrate how China's new economic prowess is enabling Beijing to project military power. Close quote. So some in Europe see an opportunity selling arms to China, but since the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989, the EU has had an embargo on same, which some EU leaders want to see lifted, including the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, in other words, their foreign minister. Back to the editorial in the London Times, quote, yet for any EU country to reinstate weapons sales would be a fundamental change in European policy and a major political and strategic decision. But China is nowhere near the level of transparency that is needed. It is in effect doubling its military expenditure in apparent denial of what that means for policy. It is not sufficient to claim that Taiwan is the sole focus of its military ambitions. That was the London Times. And look at China's reaction to the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to Liu Xiaobo. On the economic front, economist Erwin Stelzer commented in the January 17 issue of the Weekly Standard, quote, by the time they are forced to allow the yuan to appreciate significantly, the Chinese will have copied enough American and Western technology to be less in need of an undervalued currency. They will have made in China products, subsidized if necessary, that can dominate world markets even if their currency more closely approximates its market value. China's leaders know that the exports that have been filling Walmart's shelves are becoming cheaper to make in other countries, so the idea is to replace them with more technologically sophisticated products. Every deal to allow a foreign company to tap China's vast market comes with a requirement that it turn over technology. The initial orders satisfy American executives, their eyes focused on the next quarterly or analyst report. The Chinese, their eyes focused on 2020 and beyond, know that the technology in hand, they can continue duplicating the factories and techniques and dispense with the American capitalists. The camels that trod the old Silk Road, laden with spices and porcelain, are being replaced by air and sea freighters hauling solar panels and all sorts of goods based on copied technologies and purloined intellectual property. Nothing seems to have changed since Lenin observed, the capitalist will sell us the rope with which we will hang them. That was Erwin Stelzer. Camilla Cavendish, London Times. China is pursuing a supremely rational strategy, and it intends to become the world's dominant economic and military power. The regime is determined to acquire the know-how to jumpstart its own industries from foreign companies that seem willfully naive about its disregard for intellectual property rights. It will retain legitimacy by providing its people with jobs and projecting its power internationally. It is acquiring metals and minerals critical to the manufacture of many Western products. Its clear-eyed view of its own national interest makes the West look dangerously amateur. That was Camilla Cavendish. On the other side, no doubt President Hu Jintao has questions of his own when he meets with President Obama. China's foreign cash and securities reserves are now $2.85 trillion, an increase of 20% in 1 year. Seeing as how 50 to 66% of it is in the United States, between treasuries and other assets, who has a right to ask of Obama, are our assets secure? Are you going to get a handle on your deficit? It's going to be a fascinating week coming up. As for the week on Wall Street, let's start with the inflation debate. For years, I've correctly stated there is no inflation, quote, when you look at the official numbers, which is important because that is what the bond market focuses on. Yes, I've hastened to add some very important prices are rising, such as for healthcare, college tuition, property taxes, and such, and while not weighted in the official data the way they probably should be, they don't move the bond market. But they most definitely have an impact on consumer confidence, the wealth effect, and consumer spending. If you tell me the U.S. economy is going to grow at 3.5% to 4% this year, I have a hard time believing this with some of the price increases we've been seeing. Case one these days being oil and the cost to fill one's tank. If history is our guide, like in 2008 when oil spiked to $147 a barrel and over $4 a gallon, that helped stop the economy dead in its tracks, even before the financial crisis hit full bore. Today we're at 310, nationally much higher in some places, so it bears watching. I've also been very clear, however, in focusing on wages. For all the talk of rising commodities prices, labor is still far and away the main component of the vast majority of products we purchase. Until you show me that wages are picking up in a big way, I'm not going to get too excited about the cost of most of what I buy, nor should you. Individual commodities like milk and eggs can be a different story. In the developing world, though, these commodity price spikes are incredibly painful, and so this run on prices in Asia in particular, the source of much of our growth globally, is most worrisome as governments are forced to raise interest rates to try and bring prices down, and in the process slow their economies. There are a ton of moving parts to today's story, and I don't pretend to cover them all each week as much as I attempt to do. I recognize that part of the inflation problem is simple supply and demand when it comes to agricultural products, rising middle classes in Asia, apocalyptic weather patterns that have destroyed key harvests, etc. The U.S. Department of Agriculture cut its estimate on global harvest and at the same time raised its demand forecast for stuff like corn, soybeans, and wheat, all three of these being up in excess of 50% since June. What the globe needs now more than anything is good weather. Yes, otherwise, food inflation threatens to do a number on Asia big time. 828 million in India still live on $2 a day, and if the big food there, onions, is skyrocketing in price, it's not a pretty picture for these folks. And whereas the images this week were of biblical rain and flooding in Australia and Brazil, the World Economic Forum is warning of severe water shortages as well as a potential food crisis. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization recently said food prices rose a record 25% in December over year-ago figures. But I've talked about all the preceding and the essential fact for what most interests me, and I'm assuming most of you because I know few of those earning $2 a day in India are reading or listening to me, is that the U.S. stock market keeps rocketing higher, up 23.5% on the S&P 500 since the August 26 low, while despite all the concern over interest rates with a spike in December, the yield on the key 10-year Treasury sits at 3.33%, and on 12/31/09, a little over a year ago, it was 3.83%. Like, why are we then foaming at the mouth on the topic of inflation? Oh, I understand, believe me. We're waiting for that day when the Federal Reserve finally wakes up and begins to hike rates, and then everyone is going to say, I told you so, as they flee their bond funds and jump out the window. I know the historic spread between the 2- and 30-year Treasury is telling us the bond market demands to be paid for future inflation risk. Yours truly, though, will remain sanguine for a bit longer. On Friday, the report on December capacity utilization was released, and while it ticked up, it's still just 76%, i.e., there remains a ton of slack in the U.S. economy, and wake me when this particular figure hits 80%, at which point we might be talking of increasing labor costs, which aren't necessarily a bad thing if you're the one getting the raise, eh? You also have the following official data, released at week's end as well. The December producer price index rose a substantial 1.1%, but ex-food and energy was up 0.2%. Year-over-year, the PPI is up a solid 4%, but the core rate is up only 1.3%. On the consumer price side, the figure was up a worrisome 0.5%, but ex-food and energy was up 0.1%. Year-over-year, the CPI is up 1.5%, 0.8% core. No doubt, if we see another 0.5% increase in the CPI, and it's not all oil-related, alarm bells will be going off at the Fed, low capacity utilization rate or not. But here's my real bottom line. The price hikes you and I do have to deal with, not those that the bond market is focused on, are the same hikes that will limit growth. And putrid growth, though I concede bulls on this front get the first quarter of 2011, but that's about it, means price pressures will be ameliorated. Yes, the Indonesian and or Indian dealing with 7% and 8.3% inflation respectively is getting slammed, with such a large portion of their income going to put onions and rice on the table. But as those governments slam the brakes, eventually prices will come down just like they always do. For those with a short memory, see 2008. I'm also not prepared to say the world is running out of food, though in my own investing, particularly in emerging markets, I'm going to increasingly look at companies that may have solutions on this front. In China, that can mean just using the land more efficiently and employing more modern methods of agriculture. On the energy front, I also can't help but remind you that if we get a big spike related to conflict in the Middle East, short it. I mentioned long ago that when it comes to a topic like Iran, the Saudis have a ton of spare capacity and are capable of flooding the market to drive prices down. They don't want a global double dip, and they'll do everything they can to prevent one. And a note on Europe. This week the euro rose after successful bond auctions in Portugal, Spain, and Italy, but I use the term loosely because the interest rates Portugal and Spain are paying, let alone Ireland and Greece, are unsustainable. This coming week, European monetary and political leaders are gathering again to come up with a better bailout plan or more certainty, but regardless of what they agree to, the bottom line for much of the now Euro 17 is they need growth. Not 2%, but 4%. They get the latter, they can thread the needle on their crisis. If they are muddling at 1% to 2%, and even Germany is projected to see its GDP go from a solid 3.6% in 2010 to 2% this year, the euro crisis will go on and on and on. There will be good weeks, like this one, and then 4 to 6 weeks later, something else will pop up. And as I wrote in my 2011 Outlook 2 weeks ago, the transparency issue, or lack thereof, in Europe with their banks is huge. No one has a clue just what some of the exposures are within Europe's major financial institutions. CNBC had an interview this week with Ian Cheshire, the CEO of Kingfisher Group, which is the world's third largest home improvement company, and he said lack of transparency was a major worry. And when it came to the banks, we need to know, quote, what the true contingent liabilities are. Bless you, Mr. Cheshire. Lastly, folks, there has just been so much to cover the last few months. They recognize I'm leaving things on the table week to week, so I hope you forgive me. The Dow Jones and S&P 500 rose for a 7th straight week, NASDAQ 7 and 8, as this great rally continues by some measurements, the best since spring 2007. Earnings begin to come in fast and furious the next 2 weeks, though, and I'm sure they will be good. I just continue to maintain other events will eventually overwhelm Wall Street. The Dow rose 1% to 11,787, while the S&P added 1.7% and NASDAQ 1.9%. Bank stocks did well much of the week, as the bigger ones should be getting permission from the Federal Reserve to raise dividends again. J.P. Morgan Chase's earnings were solid. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. I have a very extensive analysis of the crisis in Lebanon on my Week in Review column, so go to stocksnews.com, click on Week in Review, and again, have a great week, and I'll talk to you next Saturday.